The Sikhs continue to suffer under the yoke of Nawab Zakaria Khan, but all his efforts to crush their spirit fail. A new king rises in the West and casts a long shadow on the homeland of the Sikhs. As Nawab Kapoor Singh ages, his protege gets ready to step into his shoes. Before we begin the episode, we have a favor to ask of you. If you find this work compelling, please be sure to rate it and write a short review. That will definitely help us get the podcast to a wider audience. I also wanted to share some exciting news with you. If you've enjoyed the rich musical offerings in our episodes, check out our new endeavor, the Gurmit Sangeet podcast. An ode to Sikh sacred music, the podcast is a curated introduction to some of the finest live recordings in the genre.
ਸਾਖੀ ਤਾਰੂ ਸਿੰਘ ਕੀ ਸੁਣੋ ਸਿੰਘ ਮਨ ਲਾਏ ਜੋ ਖਾਨ ਬਹਾਦੁਰ ਲੈ ਤੁਰਿਓ ਖੁਪਰੀ ਸਿਰੋਂ ਉਤਰਾਏ ਜੋ ਮਾਜੇ ਮੈਂ ਬਸਤ ਥੇ ਭਲੇ ਸੋ ਪੂਲੇ ਗ੍ਰਾਮ ਹਠੀ ਤਪੀ ਸਾਚੋ ਸਤੀ ਨਿਹੰਗ ਤਾਰੂ ਸਿੰਘ ਨਾਮ ਨਵਾਬ ਮੌਤ ਜਬ ਨੇੜੇ ਆਈ ਤਿਮ ਤਿਮ ਲਾਗੋ ਕਰਨ ਬੁਰਾਈ ਸਾਲ 18 ਸਈਏ ਦੋਏ Taru Singh kyo sako soe. I tell the tale of Taru Singh. Listen ye and listen well. And though he gave up his scalp, Zakaria Khan was the one who fell. Dwelt he in the land of Majja, from the village of Pula came. Resolute, true, reflective man, Nihang Taru Singh was his name. As Zakaria neared his end, evil deeds he wouldn't abjure. The year was 1822. Much did Taru Singh endure. The year was 1745, or 1802, according to the Bikrami calendar that Ratan Singh Pangu refers to. Nawab Zakaria Khan was at the end of his tether. He had put bounties on the heads of the Sikhs and had rolled out draconian laws that targeted anyone who provided food or shelter to Sikhs in hiding. Yet, his subjects continued to defy him and support the renegades. Nawab Mulkhayan ko puchyo Singh Rijak kahate paha. ਨਹਿ ਉਗਰਾਹੀ ਹਲ ਵਾਹੀ ਨਹਿ ਚਾਕਰੀ ਬਣਜ ਕਮਾਹ ਗੁਰਦੁਆਰੇ ਜੋ ਚੜ੍ਹਤ ਚੜ੍ਹਾਵੇ ਸੋ ਵੀ ਮੈਨੇ ਦੇ ਹਟਾਏ ਨਹਿ ਗੁਰੂਅਨ ਤੇ ਕੋਈ ਨਿਆਜ਼ ਹਟਾਏ ਦਈ ਮੈਂ ਸਿੰਘਣ ਕਾਜ ਓਏ ਭੁੱਖੇ ਕਿਮ ਨਾਹ ਮਰਾਹੀ ਦਾਣਾ ਪਾਣੀ ਜਿਮ ਲੱਭੇ ਨਾਹੀ ਫੌਜ ਟੋਲੇ ਉਣ ਬੰਨ ਕੇ ਰਾਹੀ ਖੋਜ ਟੋਲ ਕੇ ਮਾਰੇ ਤਾਹੀ ਰਿਜਕ ਬਿਨਾ ਕੋਈ ਜੀਵੇ ਨਾਹੀ ਓਏ ਕਿਮ ਜੀਵੇ ਰਿਜਕ ਬਿਨਾਹੀ ਪੱਤ ਸਾਗ ਖਾਏ ਮਨੁੱਖ ਕਬ ਜੀਵੇ ਜੋ ਜੀਵੇ ਤੁਰਨ ਜੋਗ ਕਿਮ ਥੀਵੇ ਐਸਟ ਹਿਸ ਮਿਨੀਅਨਸ ਦ ਨਵਾਬ ਹਾਊ ਡੂ ਦੀਸ ਖਾਲਸਾ ਸਬਸਿਸਟ ਦੇ ਹੈਵ ਨੋ ਰੈਵਨਿਊ ਟਿਲ ਨੋ ਲੈਂਡ ਨੋ ਜੋਬਸ ਨੋ ਟ੍ਰੇਡ Yet they persist. Even the offerings at their shrines, the faithful on their visits bore, the wealth that at their shrines accrued. By my decree it flows no more. Why do they not of hunger die? Grain and food the Sikhs have none. All the roads my soldiers block. Their orders are to spare no one. Bereft of food, none can survive. How is it that they still thrive? Roots and leaves are not enough. How then to fight still they strive? An informant spoke up and his words were confirmed by a treacherous Sikh chief who coveted authority.
Ik dusht tab boleo, ne bhukhe singh marahein, isi desh mein sikh rahein, unke piche khaein. Har bhagat niranjano yo bhaki, sach baat in bhai aki, aise aise singh jag mahi, singh chakaye piye nij khaein. Aap sahein ve nang ar bhukh, dekh sake neh singhan dukh, aap guzare agni naal, singhan kale pushak syaal, kai pisana pis kamave, ve bhi singhan paas puchave, baan bat kai kare majuri, bhije singhan paas zaruri, dur jaye jo chakri kar hi, aaye singhan ke aage dhar hi, singh jo par desh sidhare, bhije singhan oye guru pyare.
Spoke up then an evil man of hunger, Khalsas will not die. By the Sikhs, these men are fed. On your subjects, they rely.
Har Bhagat Niranjana then said, Lord, this man, the truth he speaks. In your lands lives many a Sikh who feeds them first, then his food seeks. Food and clothes they'll do without. They cannot bear the Khalsa's pain, fireside and cold, winter shiver. To give the Singhs their cloaks are fain. Through hard labor what they earn, to the Singhs they send it all. They sell what they can make or weave. In the hands of the Singhs their earnings fall. Some work hard in distant lands, give to the Singhs their earnings all. Even those who left their homes are at the Singhs' beck and call.
The infuriated Zakaria Khan demanded the names of his subjects who provided support to the rebels. He was determined to make an example of them. The treacherous Har Bhagat, who belonged to the Niranjani sect, spoke.
Har Bhagat Niranjaniye yo phir kahi, pulo pind ik majhe ahi, taru seng te kheti kare, saath pind ve paise bhare. De hakam kach thoda khave, bache singhan ke paas puchave, hai uste ik bhain ar mai, पीस कूट वह करे कमाई, आप खाएं वह रुखी मिस्सी, मोटा पहर आप हर लिस्सी, जो बचे सो सिंगण देवे, ओए बिन सिंगण और न सेवे, बांग सलात सुन मुंदे कान, रोट शीरनी पीर न थान, शब्द चौकी गुर अपनी की करे, सो मरने ते नैक न डरे.
Spoke again Har Bhagat Niranjan, in Majha Pula, a village its name. There dwells a farmer, Taru Singh, pays his taxes, attracts no blame. Of what's left, a bit consumes, to the Singhs the rest he sends. Mother and sister with him live, labor too they for their ends. Frugally the family lives, bodies thin in rough clothes clad. All they have is for the Singhs to honor, they are glad. To the Azan their ears are shut, offering none at shrines they make. They are wrapped in their own faith, they fear not death, make no mistake. Nawab Zakaria Khan sent an armed contingent to arrest Taru Singh and his family. The arrest of this simple, hard-working family caused great consternation, and the villagers bribed the soldiers to let his sister go. When the soldiers would not release Taru Singh, the villagers turned belligerent and were ready to fight. However, Taru Singh restrained them. He had an opportunity to confront the tyrant, to take a stand. Death was the last thing that he feared. Taru Singh was imprisoned in Lahore and tortured for several days. Finally, he was produced before Nawab Zakaria Khan.
Wah guru ki fateh bulai, akal akal kahe uch sunai, sunat nawab at sokhat bhayo, kaat angal jan loon lagayo, Taru Singh ji tab kahyo, tu sun baat nawab, ਮਾ ਤੁਮਰੋ ਨਾ ਬਿਗਾੜਿਓ ਤੁਮ ਕਿਨ ਦੇਤ ਅਜ਼ਾਬ ਜੋ ਹਮ ਤੁਮਰੀ ਭੂ ਬਿਗਾਰੇ ਤੋ ਤੁਮਕੋ ਹਮ ਪੈਸੇ ਭਰੇ ਔ ਜੋ ਵਣਜ ਵਪਾਰ ਹਮ ਕਰੇ ਤੋ ਵੀ ਤੁਮਰੋ ਹਾਸਲ ਭਰੇ ਤੁਮਕੋ ਦੇ ਕੇ ਜੋ ਰਹਿ ਜਾਏ ਸੋ ਹਮ ਆਪਣੇ ਪੇਟਣ ਪਾਏ ਆਪਣੋ ਤਨ ਪੇਟ ਰੱਖ ਕੇ ਊਣੀ ਦੇਤ ਔਰ ਕੋ ਚਬੜ ਚਬੂਣੀ ਕਹਿ ਤੇਰੀ ਕਿਆ ਗਾਠ ਹੋ ਜਾਏ ਹਮਕੋ ਤੁਮ ਕਿਮ ਦੇਤ ਸਜਾਏ ਨਵਾਬ ਅੱਗੇ ਥੋ ਕ੍ਰੋਧਿਤ ਭਰਿਓ ਮੁਖ ਤੇ ਖੋਟਾ ਬਚਨ ਉਚਰਿਓ ਵਿਕਟਰੀ ਟੂ ਦ ਟਾਈਮਲੈਸ ਲੋਰਡ ਅਕਾਲ ਅਕਾਲ ਦ ਸਿੱਖ ਡਿਕਲੇਮਡ ਮਚ ਸ਼ਗ੍ਰਿੰਡ ਵਾਜ਼ ਜ਼ਕਰੀਆ ਖਾਨ ਡੀਪ ਖਤਸ ਵਰ ਬਾਈ ਸਾਲਟ ਇਨਫਲੇਮਡ ਸਪੋਕ ਅਪ ਦੈਨ ਭਾਈ ਤਾਰੂ ਸਿੰਘ ਮਾਈ ਵਰਡਸ ਨਵਾਬ ਯੂ ਹੈਵ ਟੂ ਹੀਅਰ Have I ever done you harm? You threaten me with torture, fear. All your lands that I do till, to you I pay taxes fair. Through trade and labor what I earn, of that too I pay my share. After taxes what is left, with that I my stomach fill. When my meager needs are met, I put the rest in the common till. Never do I take what's yours. Why do you then punish me? Zakaria Khan was filled with rage. On his lips were word beastly.
Nawab kahe tu ho musalman, to chhadanga tumri jaan. Singh kaheo ham dar kya jaano, ham hove kim musalmano. Musalman kar marona nahi? ਜੋ ਫਿਰ ਮਰੇ ਕਿਮ ਧਰਮ ਗਵਾਈ ਚਈਏ ਨਵਾਬ ਤੇ ਧਰਮ ਰਖਾਇਆ ਕੇਸੀ ਸਾਸੀ ਨਿਭਾ ਕਰਾਇਆ ਫਿਰ ਨਵਾਬ ਇਹੀ ਕਹੀ ਜਿੰਦ ਚਹੇ ਤਾਂ ਆਵੋ ਦੀਨ ਔਰ ਜੋ ਚਾਹੋ ਮਾਂਗ ਸੋ ਧਨ ਔਰ ਮੁਲਖ ਜ਼ਮੀਨ ਔ ਮੁਗਲ ਪਠਾਨਨ ਬੇਟੀ ਲੇਹ ਬੀਚ ਹਵੇਲਣ ਬਾਸ ਕਰੇਹ ਤਬ ਸਿੰਘ ਜੀ ਨੇ ਬਚਨ ਉਚਾਰੋ ਸੋ ਦੇ ਹਮ ਕੋ ਜੋ ਲਗੇ ਪਿਆਰੋ ਤੁਮ ਜੋ ਹਮ ਪੇ ਹੈ ਮਿਹਰਬਾਨ ਆਖ ਹਮੇ ਨਾ ਹੋ ਮੁਸਲਮਾਨ ਤੂੰ ਦੱਸ ਹਮੇ ਕੁਛ ਐਸੇ ਰਾਹ ਕੇਸੀ ਸਾਸੀ ਹੋਏ ਨਿਬਾਹ ਦ ਮੁਸਲਿਮ ਫੇਥ ਯੂ ਸ਼ੈਲ ਇੰਬਰੇਸ ਸਪੇਅਰਡ ਓਨਲੀ ਦੈਨ ਯੋਰ ਲਾਈਫ ਸ਼ੈਲ ਬੀ ਸਕਫ ਦ ਸਿੰਘ ਆਈ ਡੂ ਨਾਟ ਕੇਅਰ I will not follow your decree. Surely Muslims die one day. Why should I my faith abjure? To my faith, Nawab, I'll cling as long as I breathe for sure. Once again, said the Nawab, abjure your faith and you will live. Ask for all the wealth you want. Lands, estates to you I'll give. Embrace you can a Muslim bride. A mansion high your home can be. Prompted was to say the Singh. Then give me what is dear to me. If you are magnanimous, ask me not my faith to change. Instead of that, show me a path. Do not me from my faith estrange.
Zakaria Khan's fury knew no bounds. Taru Singh should have prostrated himself on the ground, begging for mercy. His defiance would not go unpunished. He would be made an example of.
Tab Nawab bahu gussa khaya, mukh te khota bachan sunaya, jutan saath karo baal dur, naiyan kahyo sir munnan zarur, ਤਬ ਤਾਰੂ ਸਿੰਘ ਉਸ ਕਹਿਓ ਵਹਿ ਜੂਤੋ ਤੁਮਾਰੇ ਪਾਹੇ ਜੋ ਸਿੱਖ ਪੂਰੇ ਸਤਿਗੁਰੂ ਤਿੰਨ ਸਿਰ ਕੇਸ ਨਿਭਾਹੇ ਤਬ ਨਵਾਬ ਨੇ ਨਵੇ ਲਗਾਏ ਉਨਕੇ ਸੰਦ ਖੁੱਡੇ ਹੋ ਆਏ ਜਿਮ ਜਿਮ ਨਵੇ ਫੇਰ ਲਗਾਵੇ ਤਿਮ ਤਿਮ ਉਨ ਹੱਥ ਭੇੜੇ ਪਾਵੇ ਜਿਮ ਜਿਮ ਨਵਨ ਨਵਾਬ ਡਰਾਵੇ ਤਿਮ ਤਿਮ ਨਵਨ ਹੱਥ ਕੰਪਾਵੇ ਕਲਾ ਖਾਲਸੇ ਤਬ ਐਸੀ ਕਈ ਨਵਨ ਦ੍ਰਿਸ਼ਟ ਮੰਦ ਤਬ ਭਈ ਨਵਾਬ ਕਹਿਓ ਇਨ ਜਾਦੂ ਚਲਾਇਆ ਕਹਿ ਨਵਨ ਕਛ ਲੱਭ ਦਿਵਾਇਆ ਅਬ ਲਿਆਵੋ ਮੋਚੀ ਦੋ ਚਾਰ ਖੋਪਰੀ ਸਾਥ ਦੇਹ ਬਾਲ ਉਤਾਰ
ਇਨ ਰੇਜ ਵਾਜ਼ ਜ਼ਕਰੀਆ ਖਾਨ ਕਰਸਿਸ ਔਨ ਹਿਸ ਲਿਪਸ ਅਪੀਅਰਡ Beaten you will be with shoes, your hair will be by barbers sheared. Calmly spoke then Taru Singh, on your head shoes will descend. Know this that the Guru's Sikhs, steadfast they will be till the end. Fetch the barbers the Nawab, lo their razors no more keen, as they tried to razors ply, useless, weak, their hands were seen. Ranted and raved the Nawab, the barber's hands trembled and shook. Such was the power of the Singh, their wits and vision both he took. The Singh has cast a magic spell, or did he the barbers pay? Go and fetch a cobbler's few, hair and scalp both they will flay. Tab Singh ji bahu bhali manai, saath ke san ke khopri jai, tau bhi hamro bachan rahai, sikhi ki gur pej rakhai, akal akal singh jaap uchare, sun nawab munde kan sare, tab nawab bahu krodhit bhara, tab nawab bahu krodhay bhara, so hukam un mochian kara, iski khopri mathe bal ਕਾਟ ਉਤਾਰੋ ਰੰਬੀ ਨਾਲ ਤਵੇ ਕਸਾਈਨ ਵੈਸੀ ਕਰੀ ਕਰ ਪੈਣੀ ਸਿਰ ਰੰਬੀ ਧਰੀ ਪੈਣੀ ਥੀ ਰੰਬੀ ਕਰੀ ਧਰ ਮੱਥਿਓਂ ਦਈ ਦਬਾਏ ਮੱਥੇ ਤੇ ਕੰਨਾਂ ਤਈ ਗਿਚਿਓਂ ਦਈ ਪੁਟਾਏ ਸਿੰਘ ਜੀ ਮੁਖ ਤੇ ਸੀਨਾ ਕਰੀ ਧਨ ਧਨ ਗੁਰਮੁਖ ਕਰਨੀ ਸਰੀ ਹਕਾਰੋ ਦੇਖ ਲੇਖ ਬਹੁ ਭਰੇ ਜੋ ਸੇ ਸੁਣੇ ਸੋ ਹੈ ਹੈ ਕਰੇ ਲੋਕ ਸਿਆਣੇ ਐਸੇ ਕਹੇ ਪਾਤਸ਼ਾਹੀ ਇਣਕੀ ਨਾ ਰਹੇ ਅਠਾਰਾਂ ਸੈ ਉੱਪਰ ਦੁਏ ਸਾਲ ਸਾਕਾ ਭਇਓ ਤਾਰੂ ਸਿੰਘ ਨਾਲ ਅਨਰਫਲਡ ਵਾਸ ਤਾਰੂ ਸਿੰਘ ਲੈਫਟ ਇਨਟੈਕਟ ਹਿਸ ਹੇਅਰ ਵੁੱਡ ਬੀ ਅਨਬਰੋਕਨ ਵੁੱਡ ਬੀ ਹਿਸ ਵਾਓ ਆਫ ਡਿਸਆਨਰ ਹੀ ਵੁੱਡ ਬੀ ਫਰੀ ਅਕਾਲ ਅਕਾਲ ਚੈਂਟਡ ਦ ਸਿੰਘ ਜ਼ਕਰੀਆਸ ਈਅਰਸ ਡਿਡ ਸੀਮ ਟੂ ਬਰਨ filled with rage then the Nawab towards the cobbler seen to turn forehead scalp and all his hair with a trowel shall be erased the butchers did as they were told on his head their tools they placed sharpened had the trowel been into his forehead it was pressed from his forehead to his ears down to his neck depressed not one sound escaped his lips spectators were shaken stirred praise be such a noble deed gasped and cried all those who heard far-sighted ones then prophesied come soon will the Mughals end the year was 1802 Glorious tale, Taru Singh's end. Almost every Sikh child growing up hears the tale of Taru Singh. In the modern world, particularly in the West, Sikh children often suffer the inevitable bullying that a distinct identity attracts. Taru Singh's commitment to the identity that the Guru bequeathed upon the Sikhs and his refusal to give up his faith in the face of unspeakable cruelty, is always held up as an example to young Sikhs whose identity places a societal burden upon them. The history of the Sikhs in the 18th century is replete with such tales of repression and defiance. The story of Taru Singh exemplifies the forging of the character of the Sikhs like none other. Shortly after the torture and execution of Bhai Taru Singh, Nawab Zakaria Khan developed a urinary tract infection and died on July 1, 1745. It is important to note that while writers such as Ratan Singh Pangu, Gyani Gyan Singh, and Baba Prem Singh describes Nawab Zakaria Khan as a cruel and oppressive tyrant and always depict him as a unidimensional villain, the view is by no means universal. Dr. Hariram Gupta, in his History of the Sikhs, Evolution of the Sikh Confederacies, citing several historians such as Khushwakt Rai, Ahmad Shah, and Sohan Lal, describes him as the last of the most popular governors of the Punjab, an able and just ruler who commanded the respect of Hindus and Muslims alike. The historian Anandram writes that after Zakaria Khan's death, for three nights in succession, no lamp was lit in any home. Thousands followed his coffin through the streets, lamenting, beating their breasts, and heaping flowers on his bier till no more flowers were left in the city. Sayyid Muhammad Latif, author of History of the Punjab, goes even further. Nawab Zakaria Khan was for many years governor of Lahore. He had a high character for probity and uprightness, and his justice was proverbial. He was popular with all the classes of the community, and he liked the people of Lahore as he was liked by them. In those days, the bigoted mullahs of Lahore were in the habit of provoking quarrels with Hindus on religious subjects and used to subject them to much annoyance. The Khan always tried to settle these disputes amicably and never showed undue favor to any particular sect. In illustration of his justice, the following story is narrated by a contemporary historian of Lahore, who had opportunities of forming an opinion of his public career. A Hindu of Lahore had the misfortune to possess a beautiful wife. A Mughal residing in the same locality became enamored of her and tried to secure her affections, but the modest woman remained loyal to her husband and rejected the Mughal's overtures with scorn. The latter thereupon resolved to obtain by stratagem what he had failed to do by persuasion. He contrived that garments such as are worn by a Mohammedan bride should be secretly introduced into the woman's apartments, and from there being found in them, on a search being instituted at his instance, endeavored to establish the fact of a secret alliance with her. But his wiles were laid bare by the governor, who, in the disguise of a fakir, himself ascertained the actual state of affairs and ordered the Mughal to be put to death. Several other anecdotes of the justice of Nawab Zakaria Khan are related by the people. Regardless of where the truth lies, Nawab Zakaria Khan was a towering figure in the Punjab for two decades, and his death left a power vacuum. His uncle Qamaruddin Khan, also his father-in-law, was still vizier in the court of Muhammad Shah and wielded significant power. Lahore was an important province, and furious jockeying started at the Mughal court for the position of governor. It will be useful to revisit the various factions vying for power as the sun was setting on the Mughal Empire. After the death of Saadat Khan during Nader Shah's invasion, his son-in-law Safdarjung became the governor of Awadh and the leader of the Persian faction, against which was ranged the Turani faction led by Vizier Qamaruddin Khan. For almost three decades following the invasion of Nader Shah, the history of the Mughals would greatly be influenced by the battle between these two factions. Zakaria Khan was survived by three sons, Yahya Khan, Hayatullah Khan, also known as Shah Nawaz Khan, and Mir Baqi. The older sons rushed to Lahore to stake their rival claims, and their followers came to blows until a settlement was reached. The more powerful brother Shahnawaz retreated to his command in the Jalandhar Doab after being paid off in cash and jewels. Since Zakariya Khan and his sons were very much part of the Thurani faction, Muhammad Shah was persuaded by their enemies to leave the governorships of both Lahore and Multan vacant rather than giving them to Zakariya Khan's sons. Wazir Qamaruddin Khan claimed the governorship of Lahore for himself, and the emperor reluctantly agreed, appointing Yahya Khan as deputy governor after months of uncertainty and turbulence. Mir Munim, one of Zakariya Khan's most capable and faithful retainers, was also appointed as a deputy by the vizier. Lakhpat Rai, who had been Zakariya Khan's Diwan or minister, and his brother Jaspat Rai, who was the commander of Aminabad, continued to wield influence after their master's death. In early 1736, a band of Sikhs under the command of Jassa Singh Aluwalia were attacked by Jaspat Rai in the western Shivalik Hills. The Sikhs fled towards the west and reached the vicinity of Aminabad, where they sheltered in the forests close to the village of Badoki. The Sikhs had set up camp and were preparing their evening meal when a messenger from Jaspat Rai arrived. Jaspat Rai demanded that they leave his territories at once. The Sikhs said that they had been in the saddle for 3 days and were tired and hungry. They swore that they bore Jaspat Rai no ill will and they would leave soon. The haughty Jaspat Rai, however, was having none of it. Threatening that he would shave all of their heads, he attacked just as the Sikhs were about to eat. Their camp encircled by Jaspat Rai's forces, the trapped Sikhs broke out of the cordon, and instead of fleeing, they wheeled around and engaged Jaspat Rai in an open field. Jaspat Rai's forces, taken aback by the ferocity of the attack, beat a hasty retreat. A daring Sikh named Nabab Singh grabbed the tail of Jaspat Rai's elephant and clambered into the howdha. In an instant, Jaspat Rai's decapitated head fell to the ground. After the battle, Baba Kirpa Ram of Gosai, who was the spiritual mentor of Jaspat Rai, came to claim the head, which the Sikhs made over to him for a sum of 500 rupees. Kirpa Ram hastened to Lahore with Jaspat Rai's head and laid it at the feet of Diwan Lakhpat Rai, who swore vengeance and left for Aminabad to look for Jassa Singh Aluwalia and his men. Yahya Khan, his master, immediately issued a proclamation for the general massacre of Sikhs. Lakhpat Rai searched for the Sikhs in vain and returned to Lahore frustrated. Sikh shopkeepers and merchants were rounded up and several were executed. A group of prominent citizens, including a well-known Hindu leader Diwan Koramal and Gosai Sant Jagat Bhagat, Lakhpat Rai's own spiritual mentor, approached the Diwan. Jaspat Rai had fallen in battle, they said. Lakhpat Rai was within his rights to pursue his killers, but the common Sikhs of Lahore had done nothing, and they suggested that the rest of the detained Sikhs be released. Lakhmat Rai, however, was adamant and insulted the delegation, telling Jagat Bhagat that he knew nothing of politics and governance. The holy man was so offended, and he cursed Lakhmat Rai, prophesying that while the Sikhs would survive, the Diwan's name would be obliterated. On March 10th, all the arrested Sikhs were put to death. Lakhmat Rai now put together a large force and started looking for the Sikh warriors who had killed his brother. At that time, about 15,000 Sikhs were hiding in the marshes around the village of Kanuwan. The leaders present there with their bands were Nawab Kapoor Singh, Jassa Singh Aluwalia, Sukha Singh, Gurdayal Singh Dalewala, and Charat Singh Shukarchakia. Lakhmat Rai's army encircled them, and the Sikhs started to engage them with their usual hit-and-run tactics. The Mughal force was huge and equipped with artillery, and the lightly provisioned Sikhs knew that they were in trouble. Many of them were on foot, and escaping seemed impossible. They launched several daring raids on Lakhmat Rai's camp and managed to capture many horses, making off with the Mughal army's provisions. An enraged Lakhmat Rai ordered his men to intensify the attack, and the Sikhs, reeling from the fierce onslaught, tried to flee. They reached the banks of the Ravi River and managed to cross, intending to make their way to Katuha and then on to Basholi, where they could shelter in the mountains. Their path, however, was impeded by bands of hillmen, enemies of the Sikhs, who showered them with bullets. Trapped between the hillmen and Lakhmat Rai's forces that were in pursuit, the Sikhs split up into several bands to make it easier to escape towards the south. The Ravi was by then swollen and the Sikhs were unable to cross. Jassa Singh decided that it was better to die fighting than drowning, and a detachment of Sikhs led by Sukha Singh turned around to engage the pursuers. In the pitched battle that followed, Rarbhaj Rai, the son of Lakhmat Rai, and Yahya Khan's son, Nahar Khan, along with several other Mughal commanders, were killed. Sukha Singh's thigh bone was shattered, but he bandaged his leg and kept on fighting. The battle was fought on May 1st, 1746. In all the years of repression and resistance, the Sikhs had never suffered such significant casualties. 7,000 Sikhs lost their lives and 3,000 were captured, including those detained by the hill chiefs. Lakhmat Rai dragged the captured Sikhs in chains to Lahore, where they were executed. The Sikh warriors scattered in order to survive. Nawab Kapoor Singh, Jassa Singh Aluwalia, and Sukha Singh went to the Malwa and sheltered at Kot Kapura. The episode came to be known as the Chota Kalukara, or the Small Holocaust. In the words of Gyani Gyan Singh in his Panth Prakash, "Es jang mein bhayo tha panth jar joro bhur mulak malve bichar phir kari mandgi dur 10,000 singh ko kahen ko 20 bataen mare singh is jang mein turk beant mahaen 5-6-7,000 singh mareo theek tahaen ਕੱਲੂ ਕਾਰਾ ਪੰਥ ਕਹਿ ਯਾ ਤੇ ਇਸ ਜੰਗ ਤਾਹੇ ਸਨਮਤ ਸੱਸ ਬਸ ਸੂਣ ਰਿਖ ਮਾਹ ਹਾਥ ਅਹਿਸਾਰ ਭਈ ਭਯੋ ਯਾਹ ਧਿਆਏ ਇਤ ਗੁਰਪਦ ਪਦਮ ਜੁਹਾਰ ਇਨ ਦਿਸ ਬੈਟਲ ਮਾਈਟੀ ਆਫ ਪਾਵਰ ਦ ਪੰਥ ਵਾਜ਼ ਡਰੇਨਡ ਇਨ ਦ ਲੈਂਡਸ ਆਫ ਮਾਲਵਾ ਸਟਰੈਂਥ ਵਾਜ਼ ਦੈਨ ਰੀਗੇਨਡ ਸਮ ਸੈਡ ਫੈਲ 10,000 ਸਮ ਸੈਡ 20 ਡਾਈਡ ਸਲੋਟਰਡ ਵਰ ਦ ਖਾਲਸਾ ਮੁਗਲ ਸਵੈਲਡ ਵਿਦ ਪ੍ਰਾਈਡ 6,000 or 7,000 perished then for sure as a holocaust in memory this battle will endure. Sunmuth 1807 was when this blow fell. The tale will be remembered. All will with respect retell. It is now time to introduce another character who would go on to impact the fortunes of the Sikhs very significantly in the decades to follow. In the years when Nader Shah was consolidating his power and readying himself to claim the throne of Persia, Khorasan had remained in ferment. The rough, barren land was a sea of shifting alliances between rival tribes, forever jockeying for power and influence. In 1722, a son was born to Muhammad Zaman Khan Abdali, the governor of Herat, and his wife, Zarghuna Alakozai. In 1729, after Nader Shah invaded Khorasan, the young Ahmad Khan, whose father had perished in battle shortly after his birth, had fled with his family south to Kandahar and took refuge with the Ghizlais. He and his brother Zulfikar Khan, viewed as future rivals, had been imprisoned by Shah Hussein Hotaki, the Ghizlai ruler of Kandahar. In 1731, Nader Shah had already begun enlisting Abdali tribesmen from Herat into his army, recognizing their warlike nature and their renown for bravery. Ahmad Khan and his brother had been freed by Nader Shah when he captured Kandahar on his way to Delhi in 1738 and had been recruited into his service. The Ghizlais had been expelled from Kandahar and the Abdalis had begun to settle in the city. Olaf Karo, in his account, The Pathans, writes about the rise of the Abdalis in Nader Shah's service. Impressed with their gallant bearing, he treated them generously. Ahmad shortly rejoined him to serve as an officer in the new corps of Afghan mercenaries, which the usurper Nader Shah was now raising. The Afghan contingent became the corps d'elite of Nader's army, of which the Abdalis formed the largest support. Estimates of the strength of this corps vary between 4,000 and 16,000, and all accounts agree that the Afghan corps of horse formed Nader's bodyguard, in whom alone he had complete reliance. This body of men accompanied their master to India and participated in all the dangers and successes of that campaign. The murder of a number of them by the Delhi mob set the conqueror at flashing point and led him to unleash his fury upon Delhi. Ahmad Khan proved himself in Nader Shah's service and was promoted from his personal attendant to commander of a 4,000-strong unit of the Abdali cavalry. His men displayed great valor and literally saved Nader Shah's skin when he was attacked by Afridi tribesmen in the Khyber Pass. Eager to relieve him of his plunder when he was returning to Persia from Delhi. At the time of the Chota Kalukara, Ahmad Shah was well entrenched in the inner circle of Nader Shah. Almost a year had passed since the Chota Kalukara, and the Sikhs had started to regroup. In March 1747, they decided to take back Amritsar, which was being administered by Salabat Khan, a brave Mughal commander. Jassa Singh Ahluwalia was chartered with leading the attack, and after a fierce battle in which Salabat Khan was killed by Jassa Singh and his nephew Nazabat Khan by Nawab Kapoor Singh, the Sikhs took Amritsar again. Once more, it became possible for Sikh pilgrims to visit the Sri Harmandir Sahib and bathe in the sacred pool. After Yahya Khan was formally appointed the de facto governor of Lahore, he let Mir Munim continue in a senior advisory role, governing the turbulent province constantly faced with the Sikh insurgency was much more than the weak Yahya Khan could handle. To make matters worse, his aggressive brother Shahnawaz Khan constantly created trouble as he continued to eye the governorship of Lahore. Matters came to a head in November 1746, when Shahnawaz Khan traveled to his mansion outside Lahore and demanded that a final settlement be made between him and Yahya Khan to divide up all of the late Zakaria Khan's assets. The discussion was long, convoluted, and inconclusive. Armed followers of the two brothers fought in the streets multiple times as the standoff continued. In March 1747, Shahnawaz, unable to pay his soldiers their back pay, lost his patience and sent his lieutenant Adina Beg Khan to attack his brother. Mir Munim came to his master's defense and was wounded in the skirmish that followed. The next day, Shahnawaz personally led an attack, deploying artillery to scatter his brother's forces. Yahya Khan's soldiers deserted and Shahnawaz took control of Lahore. Shahnawaz Khan quickly started to consolidate his hold over Lahore, dismissing the old guard that had served his father and confiscating their property. He replaced them with his own loyalists and then tried to repair his relationship with Delhi, just having deposed the governor appointed by the imperial court. He sent an elaborate letter of apology to the emperor and expensive gifts in the hope that a settlement could be negotiated. 1,000 miles to the northwest of Lahore, tumultuous events were unfolding that would affect the fortunes of Zakaria Khan's sons as well as the Sikhs. Nader Shah in 1747 was very different from the man who had built an empire out of nothing and had been admired all over the world for his conquests. Jonas Hanway, an English merchant who visited Persia during this period, made this observation of Nader Shah, who he met in Isfahan in early 1747. From an incessant fatigue and labor of mind, attended with some infirmities of body, he had contracted a disposition which in the generality of mankind is called by the name of peevishness, but in him was a diabolical fierceness with a total insensibility of human sufferings. His avidity, as common to sickly minds, increased with his years, and in order to indulge it, he seemed resolved to perform some master stroke of cruelty. During his stay at Isfahan, he committed atrocities beyond any of the former years of his reign. Rebellions had broken out against Nader Shah's rule in various parts of his realm, which he had suppressed with great cruelty. The Shah had also imposed heavy taxes across his empire, not even sparing his own family members. So unpredictable had he become that his own sons and grandsons quaked in fear before him. Dr. Lockhart in Nader Shah describes an incident that occurred after Nader Shah left Isfahan, traveling northeast to suppress rebellions in Khorasan. At Tabas, the first town to be reached on the further side of the desert, Nader received his sons and grandsons, 16 in number, whom he had summoned to meet him there. After regarding them for some time, he offered his crown to each of the three eldest in turn. But the youths, fearing a trap, all refused, pleading their incapacity, extreme youth, and inexperience. On June 19, 1747, Nader Shah arrived in Khabhushan, where the Kurdish settlers had joined the rebellion of Ali Quli, Nader Shah's nephew who had once been his favorite. The Kurds had raided a nearby stud farm owned by the Shah, and he marched there from the town of Mashhad at the head of an army of 16,000 to punish the Kurds. Nader Shah had set up camp on high ground at Fatahabad, several miles from Khabhushan. Pierre Louis Bazin, Nader Shah's personal physician, wrote that Nader Shah clearly perceived that for some time a number of plots against his life had been in existence. Of all the nobles at his court, Muhammad Quli Khan, his relation, and Salah Khan were the most discontented and the most active. The first was in command of the guards, and the second the superintendent of his household. The latter caused him less fear because his post gave him no authority over the troops, but he dreaded the former, who was a man of swift action, esteemed for his bravery, and who was on good terms with his officers. It was on him that suspicion fell, and Nader Shah resolved to forestall him. He had in his camp a corps of 4,000 Afghans. These foreign troops were entirely devoted to him and hostile to the Persians. On the night of 19th June, he summoned all their chiefs. "I am not satisfied with my guards," he said to them. "Your loyalty and your courage are known to me. I order you to arrest all their officers tomorrow morning and place them in irons. Do not spare any of them if they dare to resist you. This is a question of my personal security, and I trust the preservation of my life to you and to you alone." Suspicious of Muhammad Quli Khan and Salah Khan, Nader had decided to strike preemptively through his trusted Afghan bodyguards, commanded by the 23-year-old Ahmad Khan, the Abdali youth that Nader Shah had rescued from captivity in Kandahar. The orders were overheard by a spy who informed Muhammad Quli Khan and Salah Khan, who quickly summoned several other Persian commanders and alerted them to the imminent purge. The Persian chiefs decided to murder the Shah the same night before they were targeted by his Afghan guard. Nader Shah was in his tent with his favorite concubine Chukki when the conspirators arrived. Such was the terror that Nader Shah inspired that most of them lost their nerve. Three men found the courage to enter. One was the steward Salih Khan, and the other was Muhammad Qajar Khan, Chukki's father. The girl, who awoke, first shook Nader Shah awake in great alarm, who grabbed a sword and sprang to his feet and charged at Salih Khan. Before he could reach him, he tripped on a rope and fell. Salih Khan, who swung his sword and managed to slice off one of Nader Shah's hands, was suddenly struck with terror and froze. Muhammad Qajar Khan swooped in and cut off Nader Shah's head. In Olaf Karo's words, "Hearing a tumult, Ahmed and his men rushed towards the standard, thinking to protect their king. Their way was barred by strong forces of Kizilbash, greatly outnumbering the Afghans, but Ahmad Khan, bound in a loyal cause, hacked his way through and entered the royal tent, only to find Nader's headless trunk lying in a pool of blood." The Abdali devotion to the king was real, and they were overcome by mixed emotions: horror over the loss of a trusted chief, and shame that they whom he trusted had failed him. They found the time to give expression to their grief, and then once more fought their way through and, taking to horse, made off to Kandahar. Ahmed Shah might have been devastated by the murder of his mentor and king, but his death created a huge opportunity for the young chief. Nader Shah had extended Persian rule far to the east, capturing Kandahar, Kabul, Multan, Deirajat, and Peshawar, which had all been Mughal provinces. During his flight to Kandahar, Ahmad Khan Abdali was able to capture a Persian convoy carrying much of the treasure that Nader Shah had looted during the Delhi campaign, including the fabulous Kohinoor diamond. Upon arriving in Kandahar, Ahmad Khan deposed the ruler, Nur Muhammad Ali Zai, and took control of the province. In October 1747, the chiefs of the dominant Abdali and Ghizlai tribes met near Kandahar for a Loya Jirga, or tribal council, to choose a leader. The proceedings of the council are colorfully described in Brigadier General Sir Percy Sykes' History of Afghanistan. The chiefs of the Abdali and Ghizlai tribes then assembled at the tomb of Sheikh Siurk in the neighborhood of Kandahar to decide upon the formation of a regular government for an independent Afghanistan. The question as to who should be elected Shah created dissensions between rival chiefs, each of whom loudly pressed their own claims on the assembly. Ahmad Khan had been present at 8 of these tumultuous meetings without bringing forward his own claims or indeed offering any opinion on the subjects being discussed. Such was the position when the highly respected dervish who was the guardian of the tomb rose and exclaimed, "Why all these verbose words? Allah has created Ahmad Khan a much greater man than any of you. He belongs to the most noble of all Afghan families. Maintain therefore the work of Allah or fear his wrath." Haji Jamal Khan, the most influential chief present at the meeting, upon hearing this speech, immediately withdrew his own claims in favor of Ahmad Khan. The dervish, whose name was Baba Sabir, and who was Ahmad Khan's spiritual mentor, poured some wheat into his hand and then fashioned a wreath of straw and crowned Ahmad Khan. "May this be your crown," he declared grandly. The ceremony signified that Ahmad Khan's rule would be marked by abundance and prosperity. The 23-year-old Abdali chief took the title Ahmad Shah and founded the Kingdom of Afghanistan. Olaf Kuro offers a no less colorful but slightly more cynical version. According to him, the powerful chief decided that the callow youth, who came from the Sadozai clan, a weak branch of the Popalzai clan, would be fairly pliable and could easily be deposed. He quotes here the account contained in the autobiography of Amir Abdurrahman, who ruled Afghanistan decades after these events. Agreeing on this, all took pieces of grass in their mouths as a token that they were his cattle and beasts of burden, and throwing pieces of cloth around their necks as a sign of willingness to be led, submitted to his rule and gave him powers of life and death. Haji Jamal Khan, whose decision to withdraw from the race was an important factor in Ahmad Shah's ascension, belonged to the powerful Barakzai clan, and he became the new ruler's vizier or prime minister, with the understanding that the position would be hereditary and would lay the foundation of a strong alliance between the Sadozais and the Barakzais. The new ruler of Afghanistan took the title Dur-e-Durran, or Pearl of Pearls, and the Abdalis were from then on known as the Durranis. The young king immediately set about the task of unifying the Afghan tribes, promising that glorious times lay ahead. Thousands answered his call and flocked to his banner. Very quickly, he took Kabul and then sent a force further east to take Peshawar and plunder his way to the Indus River at Attock. The governor of Peshawar, Nazir Khan, abandoned his city and fled to Lahore. Shahnawaz Khan had deposed his brother, but he was extremely nervous about his future since he had revolted against Delhi and he had aroused the ire of Wazir Qamaruddin Khan. He had been following the developments in Afghanistan with great interest, and in order to hedge his bets, he sent an invitation to Ahmad Shah Abdali to invade the Mughal Empire. Ahmad Shah Abdali, who had taken Peshawar by then, was already planning to attack India. With an army of 18,000, he crossed the Indus over a bridge of boats. About a third of his men were Abdali veterans who had followed him from Persia. The rest were Afghan adventurers and camp followers. The army crossed the Jhelum and the Chenab and approached Lahore on January 8, 1748, leaving plundered and burning villages in its wake. Shahnawaz Khan had been reminded of his obligations to the Mughal Empire and his family history of fealty by his uncle, Wazir Qamaruddin Khan. Jadunath Sarkar, in his work, Fall of the Mughal Empire, Volume 1, recounts a most interesting incident. Ahmad Shah Abdali's religious guide, Baba Sabir, entered Lahore alone to visit his mother, who was living in the city, and also to make a pilgrimage to the local saints' tombs. But really, his purpose was to deliver to Shahnawaz an invitation from Abdali to join him. His fame as a magician had preceded him, and people talked about how his spells had turned a number of toy tents and horses into real cavalry and war equipment for Abdali immediately after Nader's death. It was reported that Sabir had come to Lahore to render the Mughal artillery powerless by his charms. So formidable an enemy could not be suffered to escape. He was at once arrested by the order of Shahnawaz Khan and the next day put to death by a subordinate officer without the governor's knowledge. The next day, the Afghans crossed the Ravi and made their way to the Shalimar Gardens east of Lahore, where Shahnawaz Khan's army of 16,000 awaited them. Ahmad Shah Abdali sent 1,000 mounted musketeers to engage them, who completely routed the larger Mughal force. The only commander who resisted the Afghans was Adina Beg. Shahnawaz Khan abandoned his city and fled for his life. Mir Munim and some of the late Zakaria Khan's other advisors visited Abdali's tent to beg for mercy. Lahore was saved from being plundered in return for a ransom of 3 million rupees. Ahmad Shah appropriated all the property of the governor, as well as the horses, artillery, and the military stores of Lahore. He also drafted 6,000 men into his cavalry, who were only too happy to switch sides and follow the young king, whose fortunes were clearly on the upswing. Towards the end of January, a band of Sikhs that included Nawab Kapoor Singh, Jassa Singh Ahluwalia, and Charat Singh Shukarchakia was in the vicinity of Tarn Taran. The Sikhs, largely to test the Afghan strength, attacked their camp at Sarai Noordin and again at Verowal. Using their usual hit-and-run tactics, they managed to make off with some plunder, much to Ahmad Shah Abdali's annoyance. His attention, however, was elsewhere. There was news that the emperor was readying a large force to meet the Afghan threat. Gearing up to take on the imperial Mughal army, which was much larger than his own force, was Abdali's priority. On February 19, 1748, Ahmad Shah Abdali left Lahore for Delhi, Having appointed Jalle Khan, one of the Pathan chiefs of Kasur, the new governor of Lahore. As Ahmad Shah crossed the Satluj River, Jassa Singh Ahluwalia and Nawab Kapoor Singh left for the Doaba region, while Charat Singh Shukar Chakia and Sukha Singh led a second contingent to Kalanaur. Jalle Khan, who had got wind of the Sikhs' activities after the engagements at Sarai Noordin and Verowal, sent an army to Kalanaur to engage the Sikhs. A fierce battle was fought in which Charat Singh and Sukha Singh managed to beat back the force from Lahore. Exhibited its usual ineptness in the face of the upcoming confrontation with the Afghans. It seemed that the memories of the humiliation suffered at the hands of Nader Shah less than a decade earlier had already started to fade. The emperor, who had ruled for 28 years, barely ever venturing out of Delhi, was singularly ill-equipped to deal with the new threat. His ease-loving vizier, Qamaruddin Khan, was no better. The swashbuckling commanders who thronged the court had never seen battle, and when it was suggested that the emperor personally lead the imperial forces, they bragged disdainfully that Ahmad Shah Abdali was not worth the emperor's personal attention and that any Mughal noble was capable of dragging him to Delhi in chains. The vizier, wiser than the braggarts, advised the emperor to be proactive and send an army to engage the Afghans, possibly at Karnal or Panipat, even volunteering to lead it. A massive army, 200,000 strong, was assembled and began its ponderous march from Delhi. Vizier Qamaruddin Khan was the supreme commander, assisted by Nawab Safdarjung of Awadh, Raja Ishwari Singh of Jaipur, and Nasir Khan, the deposed governor of Kabul and Lahore. The army had barely traveled 16 miles out of Delhi when news of the fall of Lahore was received. Demoralized and frightened, the nobles requested that Muhammad Shah send his son Prince Ahmad to lead the Mughal army. Prince Ahmad left Delhi on the 31st of January and arrived in Sarand on February the 19th, where he discovered that the commander, Ali Muhammad Rohilla, had fled, leaving the second most important city in the Punjab completely undefended. The main Mughal army arrived at Sarand as well, and the vizier left his harem and baggage there, guarded by a detachment of 1,000 soldiers. Neglecting to send out scouts in advance and having no knowledge of Abdali's movements, the Mughal force lumbered out of Sarand on the 27th of February, heading towards Machhiwara to cross the Satluj rather than taking the more direct route via Ludhiana. Abdali, meanwhile, had approached the Satluj at Ludhiana. He made the crossing on March 1st and, skirting the main Mughal force, he swiftly attacked and took Sarand. Immense plunder and military supplies fell into Abdali's hands, which he promptly dispatched to Lahore so that he could engage the imperial force unencumbered. News of his victory in Sarand created panic in the streets of Delhi. Another Nader Shah approached. Who knew what was in store for the citizens of the Mughal capital? The emperor glumly prepared for the inevitable and sent out a detachment with artillery to the northwest of the city to halt Ahmad Shah Abdali's advance. The city gates were shut and the terrified residents were prevented from leaving. When Prince Ahmad got wind of the fall of Sarand, he led the Mughal army to the village of Manupur, 10 miles northwest of the city and started to dig in. Trenches were dug, mud walls were erected, and the tents of important officers and nobles were ringed with artillery. The huge army was spread out over a distance of 14 miles. Ahmad Shah Abdali marched north from Sarand and set up camp a few miles from Manupur. He brought just 7 pieces of light artillery and 1 large cannon. Small bands of Afghans skirmished daily with Mughal patrols and inflicted heavy casualties. Food and water were running low in the Mughal camp, and Wazir Qamruddin ordered that the Mughal artillery be deployed. Fruitless cannon fire continued for 7 days, the Afghans prudently staying out of the range of the heavy Mughal guns. Ahmad Shah Abdali had his 1 large gun hauled to a hillock and started bombarding the Mughal camp with deadly accuracy. On March 11th, Wazir Qamruddin decided that launching a frontal attack was advisable in the face of the deadly Afghan cannonade. As he readied to mount his elephant, he was struck by an Afghan cannonball and mortally wounded. Before dying, the vizier summoned his son Muin-ul-Mulk and asked him to lead the attack in his stead. The Mughal army was split into 4 divisions. In the vanguard was Muin-ul-Mulk, leading his father's Turkish brigade. On the right flank was Nawab Safdarjung, commanding an army of Persians and Purbiyas, or Eastern Hindustanis. At the center was Prince Ahmad with his attendants and their soldiers. On the left flank was the Rajput cavalry, led by Raja Ishwari Singh. Muin-ul-Mulk's vanguard was spread thinly out in front, from the right flank to the left flank. The baggage camp was behind the center. The imperial army had about 60,000 fighting men to Abdali's 12,000. The Afghans attacked fearlessly. A 3,000-strong force of Kizilbash warriors, Turks settled in Persia, under the command of Muhammad Taqi Khan Shirazi, charged the center. Muin-ul-Mulk and his men fought bravely, inflicting heavy casualties on the Afghans. On the right wing, the Rajputs drew their swords, drunk on their legacy of valor, waiting for the Afghans to attack. Abdali sent a 3,000-strong contingent of cavalry with 200 jamburaks, small swivel guns mounted on camels. The jamburaks wreaked havoc in the Rajput ranks as they were mowed down by successive volleys. Their swords useless, the Rajputs turned tail and ran, abandoning their kettle drums, their light artillery, and their baggage. The pursuing Afghans got to the baggage camp and started to plunder. Muin-ul-Mulk, aided by his brother Fakhruddin Khan and Adina Beg, mounted a fierce counterattack against the Afghans, both sides once again taking heavy casualties. On the right flank, Abdali had positioned 700 jamburaks to decimate Safdarjung's force. The Nawab, however, ordered 1,700 of his matchlock men to dismount and charge the hillock, which they did with devastating effect. The Afghans on the right flank were routed, and Safdarjung then turned to Prince Ahmad and Muin-ul-Mulk's aid. Ahmad Shah Abdali's men had managed to make away with several cartloads of rockets and ammunition. In a stroke of misfortune, the carts caught fire due to the carelessness of the Afghans, burning 1,000 of their number to death and creating utter confusion in their ranks. Ahmad Shah Abdali ordered a retreat and left under the cover of darkness with less than 3,000 men, many of them wounded. The imperial force was too sluggish to pursue the Afghans through the thick forests that covered the land between Sarand and the Sutlej, and Ahmad Shah Abdali made it safely back to Lahore. From there, he returned to Kandahar via Peshawar. Ahmad Shah Abdali had already encountered the Sikhs on his way to Sarand from Lahore. He was the subject of his attentions again as he was journeying back after his defeat at Manupur. In the words of the historian Sohan Lal, from his work Umdat Uttarikh, since Ahmad Shah had left Lahore, Sardar Charat Singh got a good opportunity to attack the rear ranks of the Durranis. On the banks of the river Chenab, he succeeded in plundering considerable wealth and horses from the Durranis and chased them up to the river Attock. Sardar Charat Singh's strategy resulted in two major benefits. First, during their return journey, the Durranis could not indulge in looting and plundering, and thus the country was saved from ruin at their hands. Secondly, the valor of Sardar Charat Singh came to dominate the whole area. On April 9th, letters were received from the emperor. The imperial army was urgently recalled to the capital. Muinul Mulk was appointed the new governor of Lahore, and Nasir Khan to his old post at Kabul. Prince Ahmed took his army back to Delhi as the two governors rode out to their provinces. Right around the time when Ahmad Shah Abdali was battling the imperial army near Sarand, a band of Sikhs was traveling north. Jassa Singh Ahluwalia, Jai Singh Kanaiya, Hari Singh and their men arrived at Noorpur in the hills beyond Pathankot. The Sikhs had an encounter with Raja Gurdit Mal, who was a commander of the hill territories and owed allegiance to Diwan Lakhpat Rai, the great enemy of the Sikhs. The Sikhs vanquished Gurdit Mal's 12,000-strong army and made their way to Jammu and then on to Anandpur Sahib. From there, they proceeded to the Dawab, where they encountered Adina Beg, formerly the lieutenant of Shah Nawaz Khan, who had acquitted himself well at the Battle of Manupur. Adina Beg was traveling back home on leave after having obtained permission from Muinul Mulk and Prince Ahmed. A practical man, Adina Beg had always tried to maintain diplomatic relations with the Sikhs, and as an important commander charged with keeping peace in the Doab, he had persuaded the Sikhs not to plunder the territories he was accountable for. The Sikhs let Adina Beg pass unmolested and continued on to Amritsar. Vaisakhi of 1748 was celebrated with great joy by the Sikhs. They had regained control of Amritsar, and an enormous gathering of Sikhs from all over was organized. Nawab Kapoor Singh had also returned from the Doab, as had Charat Singh Shukar Chakia after harrying the departing Afghans. Jassa Singh Ahluwalia proposed that the Sikhs, who were weary of sheltering in forests and mountains, should build a fort. A conclave of all the Sikh chiefs was held, and it was decided that Amritsar was the best place for the fort to be built. A small fortress named Ram Rauni, which could accommodate about 500, was built. As important as the decision to build Ram Rauni was, something even more important happened during the Vaisakhi of 1748. Over the years, The Sikhs had coalesced into multiple bands that were all fiercely independent. The Republican ethos of the Sikhs ensured that brave men who could fight and lead organically rose to command their own bands. At that time, there were as many as 65 bands, each with its own leader, and none of them answered to any centralized authority. Nawab Kapoor Singh had been the central force a decade earlier, but now the ranks of the Sikh warriors had swelled, and there was a need for both visionary leadership and some sort of organizational structure. Nobody was more aware of this than Nawab Kapoor Singh himself, and he had a successor in mind. His protege, Jassa Singh Ahluwalia, was widely respected among the Sikh warriors, and he had the reputation of being both a brave soldier and a brilliant strategist. On March 29, 1748, a Sarbat Khalsa, a large gathering of the Sikhs, was organized in Amritsar. Nawab Kapoor Singh proposed that the joint fighting force of the Sikhs be united under Jassa Singh Ahluwalia and be given a new name, the Dal Khalsa. The 65 bands of Sikhs were consolidated into 11 divisions, each with its own banner and leader. The bands would remain independent, but would come together as the Dal Khalsa whenever the need arose. Over time, these bands would become known as the Misals and would dominate the politics and governance of Punjab for the next 50 years, as the Mughal Empire declined even more precipitously and Ahmad Shah Abdali invaded the land repeatedly. The 11 bands were organized as follows. The Ahluwalia Jatha under Jassa Singh Ahluwalia, who would also command the Dal Khalsa when it convened to face an external threat. The Faisalpuria or Singhpuria Jatha under Nawab Kapoor Singh. The Shukar Chakia Jatha under Naud Singh, the Nishanwala Jatha under Dasaunda Singh, the standard bearer of the Dal Khalsa, the Pangi Jatha under Hari Singh Pangi, the Kanaiya Jatha under Jai Singh Kanaiya, the Nakai Jatha under Hari Singh Nakai of the village Baharwal, the Dallewala Jatha under Gulab Singh of the village Dallewal near Dera Baba Nanak on the Ravi, the Shaheed Jatha under Baba Deep Singh, the Karod Singhya Jatha under Karoda Singh of Panjgarh, and the Ramgadiya Jatha under Nand Singh Sanghania. Dr. Hariram Gupta writes about the constitution of the Dal Khalsa. Every Sikh who believed in the tenets of Guru Gobind Singh was considered a member of the Dal Khalsa without any need being felt to secure his willingness. It was thought compulsory for every individual to enroll himself in the Khalsa army in order to wage war against the enemies of his faith and his persecutors, and therefore each Sikh who was true to his faith was supposed to have become a member of the Dal Khalsa. But nobody was admitted to any of the units unless he was an active horseman and proficient in the use of arms. Every individual, even of the meanest birth, had the right to choose the leader that he would serve. The joint forces of the several subdivisions took the field either upon any predatory enterprise or to offer a bold front to the enemy. On these occasions, the army assumed the denomination of the Dal Khalsa. The chiefs had agreed by common consent that at such times, someone from among them should be appointed from time to time to head the Dal to guide them in all matters requiring united action, while the other 10 chiefs were to constitute an advisory body or council of war. It was decided that the entire body of the Sikhs would meet at the Sarbat Khalsa twice a year at Amritsar, on Vaisakhi and Diwali. At these times, matters that pertain to the entire community would be discussed and gurmatas or resolutions would be passed after a healthy debate. Dr. Gupta offers this on the import of the formation of the Dal Khalsa. The foundation of the Dal Khalsa was a step of the greatest significance in the history of the Sikhs, because it united them again in a compact body after a period of 32 years. It served the most useful purpose of giving the Sikhs an ideal of unity and power in keeping them bound together by the common tie of faith in the teeth of the severest persecution and in making them a disciplined body. The singleness of purpose and harmony made them the strongest military power of the day and prepared the way for their establishment as a political power. While Dr. Gupta's analysis is absolutely accurate, there's another aspect to what happened that day that cannot be ignored. This was nothing short of the realization of Guru Gobind Singh's grand plan. When, during his final days, he had anointed the Khalsa Panth or nation as the inheritor of his temporal power. As the Sikhs were jubilantly celebrating Vaisakhi, joyously building their fort, and rejoicing at the creation of an exciting new political structure, the new governor of Punjab, Mainul Mulk, a brave soldier and a hard man, was making his way to Lahore to take up his new position. The Sikhs would get to know him well. He is remembered in Sikh folklore as Meer Mannu.
Sikhs is written and narrated by Sarpreet Singh, author of Night of the Restless Spirits, a collection of short fiction that examines the tumultuous events of 1984 from many different angles. His previous book, The Camel Merchant of Philadelphia, tells the stories of many colorful characters who populated the court of Maharaja Ranjit Singh. The Story of the Sikhs is produced by Almast Media. Our theme music is a rendition of a traditional Sikh hymn by the late Bhai Avtar Singh. This episode features a rendition of Raga Abhogi on violin by Praveen Chiolikar, with tabla accompaniment by Supreet Deshpande. Season 3 of Story of the Sikhs is sponsored by the Chardi Kala Foundation, the Sawhney Family Foundation, and Manpreet Kaur and Ishdeep Singh. I'm co-producer and audio engineer Erica Wong. Thank you for joining us.